Welcome, coaches and fellow split talkers, to the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Officer at Basketball Victoria. Joined with me once again is the High Performance Coach for the Victoria Country Women, Zoe Carr. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me. Really impressed that we've managed to press record this time.
Yes, I've got no out on that. Unfortunately, I do this a little bit too often, it turns out. And it's funny, I never used to have this problem before we upgraded the equipment. All of a sudden, we actually have like a little bit of a mixer board and things like that, and the big flashing button that says record on it, I frequently forget to hit. But you are getting like the best version of this now because we've practiced it three times before this. So huge win for all the podcast listeners out there. If you are managing to listen to this podcast, you've probably done so via the usual mediums, the iTunes, the Spotify's, all the other podcasts that you can download from the various places. If you are able to like, share, rate, review, subscribe, retweet, any of those kinds of things that can help us grow the podcasting audience, that would be fantastic and really appreciated on our end. Speaking of, we obviously got a great deal of great feedback from last week's podcast. So those of you that may be a little behind or have just simply forgotten in the last 6 days what's been going on, we had Jared Hillier talking last week about mental health for coaches and the like, and the feedback online was fantastic with numerous people reaching out. Not just on Twitter, but my email certainly blew up with coaches during the week saying, really appreciate the candidness, the transparency that Jared spoke about, and how it relates to them too. It's not a topic that people enjoy talking about usually, and it can be a little bit confronting, but amazing how many people go through fairly similar things and just need a little bit of a prod, I suppose, to reach out.
Yeah, sometimes you can liken it with attending clinics or watching clinics or whatever it might be. The one thing you might get out of it is validation, and it's a similar thing in this case that, you know, we go through these things as coaches and as people, and we think that potentially we're the only ones, so we keep it to ourselves. So for Jared to be as open as he was, I think it was a great thing, but it was great for our coaches to then, you know, put it out there either on social media or through making contact, you know, and I'm really hoping that people have adopted the plus four rule. You know, if I'm okay, contact another four. So the more we can do that, the better. So I just think everybody's, you know, involvement and interaction, the more we can do that, the closer we'll become to making mental health and wellness not a taboo or a dark subject. It's something that just becomes normal that we talk about.
Absolutely. So big thanks once again to Jared for jumping in. We're going to keep this very short in regard to intros because anyone that's potentially looked a little further into the podcast at the moment will probably see that this goes for a little bit longer than normal. That's our bad. We forgot to look at the timer as we were going through this. It spiraled and we went off on a couple of different tangents and topics, but we are really lucky to have Rob Mason in on the podcast today, and we'll explain a little bit about who Rob is as well. Previous Youth League Women's Assistant Coach at Diamond Valley, has been involved in the VJBL Association level coach in the basketball landscape, but is also a coach developer with the Port Adelaide Football Club. So really lucky to have had Rob jump into that, and he's one of the original listeners of Talking Split as well, which is fantastic. So we'll jump into the podcast with Rob now. Guest for this week's show is Rob Mason, who's held a dual role over the past 4 years as a PhD student at the University of Melbourne, where his thesis looked at the role of verbal feedback given from coaches to athletes, and as a coach developer for Port Adelaide Football Club, where his job involves listening to coaches as they work with their athletes and giving feedback on their feedback and creating the best learning environment for the players. It's a mouthful, but welcome, Rob, to the Talking Split podcast.
Thanks very much, Rob and Zoe. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. This is the first time we can say, like, long-time listener, first-time caller in on the podcast as well. It's Rob's been with us from the start.
I'm a fan of Talking Split. It's a great resource for coaches, and I love what you're doing. So it's cool to be on the other side of the microphone.
Well, I hope you listen back. We count the listens every week, so please do listen to yourself. It means a lot to us. We do appreciate you jumping in, though, especially given you're over in a state of freedom in Adelaide at the moment. Life is fairly normal for you, but you're doing a few things a little bit differently with your role with Port Adelaide.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a bit of a weird setup over here at the moment. We kind of in limbo, you know, are we going back into restrictions or not? So the AFL is obviously pretty well based in Victoria for the most part, and all of those decisions are getting made around what's happening there, where most of the games technically are played. So I'm doing my stuff with Port Adelaide mostly remotely at the moment, just because they need to clamp down on the number of people in contact with the players and make sure that bubble's nice and secure and not having any great unwashed people like myself, you know, being in contact with those players. So, they've got to take all the precautions they can with it being such a valuable industry for everyone involved.
Yeah, awesome. So how did your role with Port Adelaide come about?
It was a long time ago. It feels like a long time ago, back in 2016. So at that time, I was studying a Master's of Teaching, and I was also coaching at Diamond Valley. And so I was going to basketball training on a Tuesday night. Then on the Wednesday morning, I was sitting in class and reading about all these different strategies that might help students in the classroom. And I thought, maybe some of this stuff would be, you know, valuable for coaches to hear as well. So at the end of my studies, I had the chance to do a 6-month research project with a guy named John Hattie, Professor John Hattie, I should call him. And so his thing is, how do we get the best out of our students in the classroom? How do we improve student achievement? So it turns out that Professor Hattie is also a massive sports fan, but he'd never had a chance to do any sport research. And so we kind of put two and two together and did a little research project about teaching strategies in sport. And while that was all happening, we had a call from Aaron Greaves, who at the time was the head of football development at Port Adelaide. He said, "We have heard about your research. We want to improve how our coaches are teaching. Can we send you a couple of videos?" And it all kind of kicked off from there.
It's unreal. Did you have any experience with football before going to Port Adelaide and taking that research?
Look, I was a key position player for the Bowen Road Primary School under 12s, but that's about the extent of my footballing expertise. You know, there's a saying in basketball coaching, obviously, like if you can't shoot, don't let your players see that. Just let them assume that you can shoot. And I think it's the same in footy. Like I don't kick too many Sharons around because that's not really my thing. So I actually think it's probably been of benefit that I'm not a footy expert, because so many people coming into these clubs are football ex-footballers, or they're you know, kind of selling themselves as having a lot of footy knowledge. So by coming in as a naive researcher instead, I think that gives you a bit of distance from the footy decision making.
Well, it probably keeps you on track a little bit too. I think more than that, like you have a fairly defined role, and it's not to try and work out how to beat the press of Brisbane Lions or anything like that. It is no, that's not my job. I need to be doing this. And a lot of our VJBL type coaches would probably be in a fairly similar boat. Some of them may have played as a junior athlete or something like that, but there's a lot of people that get involved as a parent at a domestic level, I suppose, and that's just kind of their link into the game, and they kind of learn on the run. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a great player or a former player, your primary school career withstanding, obviously, to necessarily be a good coach. Like the two aren't mutually exclusive.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in my environment at the moment, the coaches are the experts on what they're teaching, and my expertise is more on how they're teaching it. So I don't need to know how Brisbane's running that press, or I don't need to know how GWS like moving the ball around the boundary for safety. All I need to know is they're teaching these things. I want to know what the athletes know, and I want to be able to help the coaches to adapt their strategies so that the athletes come out of that room with the right knowledge for game day. And I think the saying that I use a lot with the coaches that I work with is, you'd rather find out that they don't know in a film room full of 30 teammates than on Adelaide Oval in front of 45, 50,000 people. So that's kind of where the value is in that.
And how do those coaches go taking that sort of feedback from you? So if, let's say you notice something sort of glaring about their language or their messaging, and you bring that up with them, how do they go about taking that, especially from somebody who isn't an ex-AFL, you know, superstar of 50 years? And how do they go about taking that?
I've been extremely fortunate to work with a heap of coaches who are really open-minded and wanting to get better. It's such a fickle industry. You see coaches getting the chop all the time, as we do in basketball. And so all these coaches just want to get better. My first day walking into Port Adelaide, we had the head coach at the head of the table, sitting there going, how do I improve how I'm messaging to my players? And so all the other coaches kind of thought, oh, you know, he's not beyond it, then neither are we, you know, we're still learning. And so I was really lucky to walk into a culture that was really kind of growth mindset, wanting to improve all the time. And so the coaches are really receptive to, you know, sitting down for 10 minutes. Hey, how did you go with that last meeting? You know, do you think that guy answered that question well? they're up for that. The only time I really sit down and shut up is during a game. So they've got so much going on in the coach's box that I just, I sit up the back and stay very quiet, and now even quieter because I'm getting everything via Dropbox, given the restrictions. So, you got to know when to intervene and when not to intervene, I guess.
So what's your process look like for just say a meeting on a Monday morning, potentially a debrief as to how the game went? What does your process like? Do you jump into that meeting as well, listen to the coach talk? What are the things you look for? And then is it just a quick sit down afterwards and just go over it? How does that work?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the stage of the season. So there's probably a lot more time pre-season to get some more development in with the coaches. During the season, the weekly cycle is so tight that it's often, you know, you might not want to intervene after every meeting. It might get a little bit much kind of thing. But pre-COVID, sitting down in the meeting room, up the back of the room, just taking it all in. We record all our meetings anyway, so they all go on a server and you can access the video files. But there's so much that you pick up just by being in the room and watching. Typically, you know, if someone's filming a classroom, you've got the footage on the teacher. But the teacher's not the most important person in the room. Like, your camera really needs to be facing what the teacher's seeing at the students or at the athletes. So, being in that room is really important, taking some notes. We've got some frameworks that help us to structure feedback to the coaches on how they're teaching. The chat might be once a week. Typically, though, it's every 2 or 3 weeks to allow them some time to adjust their practice and not to overload them. You know, we don't want to overload our athletes with too much stuff and by the same token, we don't want to go in too hard with the coaches and fatigue them with, you didn't do this and this and this. So it's a balance.
Because then you can start to lose what actually makes them great because they're too busy thinking about, I have to make sure I do this or I can't do that. Or, you know, it can muck up their messaging and their passion as well, which can be something that is engaging for athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, paralysis by analysis, right? Yeah. Like, you're telling him to worry about 3 or 4 different things and suddenly someone like Ken Hinckley, the head coach at Port Adelaide, is such a passionate coach and can really get his players emotionally and psychologically ready for a game by the way that he delivers a message. And so you don't want to intervene with that too much because that's the kind of the magic that you develop over, 10, 20 years of coaching I'm not going to be able to instill that in someone in one session.
So with messaging, have you noticed any similarities or glaring differences between, say, your experience as a basketball coach and now stepping into the football realm? Are you noticing any differences in messaging or language or body language or anything like that that's really stood out to you?
Excellent question. I did actually do some interviews as part of my PhD studies where I looked at 8 different high performance coaches across basketball, Australian rules, rugby, so NRL, and some soccer coaches as well. And there are so many things that are similar across all of those sports. So, you've got a squad of athletes, might be slightly bigger or smaller. They're all dealing with the same challenges in terms of, how much of this stuff needs to go to the whole team, how much of it you need to sit down one-on-one with the athletes. I think a lot of it comes down to the culture of the sport. So if you think of an old school footy coach, you see the spray at halftime, you see the spit coming out of the mouth, the jugulars out. Similarly, in basketball, you think about some old school coaches, potentially similar. And I know, we've all had those moments as coaches where you blow on a gasket because the refs just made 2 average calls and your point guards just made 2 terrible decisions about where to, pass the ball up the floor. And we can fall into an expectation, I think, of going, this is how the great coaches coach, so this is how I should coach. It's the same with teachers in a classroom. Like, your perception of your job traditionally is, I've got to be up the front doing all the teaching. But we're trying to kind of flip that on its head, and that's got its different challenges between different sports. So, lots of similarities, a couple of differences, mainly coming down to the culture of that sport, I think, and what's expected of the coaches.
So when you spoke before about flip the camera and actually look at the audience, essentially, and I'm assuming that's what you do a fair bit in the room as well, and look at how the message is being received by the players as such. Is that things like body language, just attention, eye contact, those kinds of things, like they're fidgety and things like, because everyone is built and wired a little bit differently anyway. So there might be some nervous traits that people that sort of looks like they're disinterested, but they're actually fairly well engaged. How do you differentiate between someone that is engaged but might just have a little bit of a nervous twitch versus someone that is absolutely checked out of what's going on?
Yeah, that's the art of coaching, isn't it? Everyone's different, as you say. So, yeah, we've got some players who will look like they're half asleep, but actually they're really listening and they can answer any questions. They might be understimulated. They might know it all already. So I try to steer away from any kind of major conclusions based on body language. I think it was that TV show, like Lie to Me, where the guy was like, yeah, if you're looking to the left, it means you're doing this or that. I don't think there's too much like really strong evidence around that stuff. So I try and rely more on the evidence that the players can give to the coach at the end of the meeting. So we use things like potentially something like an exit ticket, which is what classroom teachers, if they're listening, will be very familiar with, like a little slip of paper, maybe write down three things that you took out of the meeting, compare it between the players. Is it all the same? Is it different? We are steering coaches towards that method of checking for meeting effectiveness. So we can infer attention and that kind of stuff through body language and their position in the room. You know, you've got your athletes who want to be right up the back in the corner versus your conscientious players who want to be down the front center. But yeah, we try and steer towards those more kind of concrete bits of evidence of understanding, like questioning is another hugely important one. So not just the, do you understand? You get the 30 heads nodding, but actually, what do you understand this term to mean? They've got to actually give you some evidence of what they understand. So we try to rely more on that stuff, I think.
So it's really the push versus pull. How much information do I have to push onto my athletes in this situation versus how much time do I have to spend using the open-ended type questioning where they have to explain their thoughts a little bit more and just checking their understanding, I suppose, for lack of a better term. How do you manage that time? Because that can be really time-consuming as well, trying to pull information from your audience.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, again, it comes down to the art of coaching. Like you don't know how quickly you're going to get a response to a question. It might take you 2 or 3 minutes of digging. And that's something that makes coaches nervous. You know, we've got pretty tight schedules through the week. If you're a junior coach, you might have your athletes for, you know, an hour, hour and a half tops, two times a week. If you're lucky, in the current climate, not quite as much, you're on Zoom. And so, yeah, you've got to be able to, you're almost like a triage nurse, you know, you've got to kind of pull out the really important bits and forget about the spot fires a little bit. So it's a matter of being efficient. It's a tough one. And you've got to be conscious of time. Often, you know, occasionally I'll run a meeting for the players. It might be something like, here's how you take really good notes, and it goes 2 minutes over time, and the coaches go, gee, Rob, see, you're telling us to ask lots of questions, but then you did it and you went over time. Like, if you can't do it, like, don't tell us, that kind of thing. So, it's tough. It's an art, and it develops over time and over reflection as well. Not an easy answer, unfortunately.
What sort of balance do you think through your research and your experience? You know, we talk about positive feedback and then critiquing and or negative feedback, if you want to call it that, but more so I like to call it critiquing. But, you know, you do find obviously positive feedback has its benefits in terms of confidence and, you know, the way the players feel and things like that. But obviously the critique is actually where you get better as an athlete because you have acknowledged and then can work and build on that skill to become a better athlete. But how do you see the balance between the two? Because we have had a bit of a how do I put this politically correct? We have had a bit of a trend of, you know, everything positive all the time, all, you know, and I think sometimes then that critique gets a little bit lost, and then we see athletes that can't handle the adversity where if they do step into a high performance pathway or program or whatever it might be, or they don't improve at the rate that they wish to and potentially miss out on, you know, teams or state teams or programs or whatever it might be. So what do you think, I know it's high performance is very different to a junior coach, which we have a lot of junior coaches that are listening right now. So what do you think that, how do you think that balance should probably work?
Yeah, it's probably another complex answer. And I think the simple answer is it depends. I think So we talk in coaching our players about constraints, right? Like you might make the court size smaller to get a certain outcome. You might have 3v2 to stretch the defense. We've got constraints working on us as coaches as well. And so we can be more positive or more negative based on what's happening in the game, based on is that our favorite player? Or, you know, we don't have favorites as coaches, but sometimes you like riding some players more than others. And so it's a differentiated approach, I think. It depends on how well you know your players, the type of relationship you've got with them. As you mentioned, their confidence is huge, especially at the junior levels. Like, we want to create athletes who have a really positive experience with sport so that they keep going into their senior years and they look back on their time in basketball really fondly. So it's important to give some encouragement and some positive feedback, but it's also really important to create that culture where giving some criticism is accepted as, it's a growth mindset thing. Again, it's, this is helping me to get better. This is not a knock on me as a person. It doesn't mean that I'm an average basketballer. It just means, in the same way LeBron James is working on stuff, so are your teammates, and it's expected of you as well. So I think one strategy that can kind of help with that is looking at trying to build a self-regulated athlete. So and that can start early. The earlier you start, hopefully the more the kind of culture changes. But I think it's that culture of getting athletes to think themselves about what they can do better, and rather than tell as a coach and push the feedback, starting to get some stuff out of them as well. So rather than pulling them to the sideline and going, you keep turning it over on that pass to the wing, what's going wrong at the moment? How have we turned the ball over the last three possessions? Okay, great. So what can we do ourselves, and what can we instruct our teammates to do to make sure that doesn't happen again? You're still giving them technically some criticism, some stuff to do better, but you're working alongside them to develop that understanding rather than standing above them as a coach and kind of dictating it to them. So that kind of little shift, and it takes time, and some players won't be ready for that straight away, but working towards that, I think, is one way to get around the concern about the criticism and to have the athletes on board with you rather than kind of pushing away any of that.
Yeah, it's that whole coach them to coach themselves almost. We talk about it with their shot all the time, like be your own shot doctor. So because you're going to shoot the ball so much more without a coach than you will with a coach. So if you've got the ability to understand why it missed, how it missed, and how you fix it, then that makes the coach's job 10 times easier. I think having them coach themselves is definitely a great way to negate some of that, what can be seen as negativity.
Yeah, absolutely. And you find your job as a coach is a lot easier, particularly if you've got a point guard who's really good at figuring out what's going wrong. They can pull them in at a free throw and go, guys, look, we really need to get our act together on that action. Saves you blowing a timeout a lot of the time. And really, it seems counterintuitive, but I think our job as coaches is to make ourselves as redundant as possible so that our players can go and do it. Because, I mean, sometimes we jump in and scrimmage at training if the numbers are low, but damn, we're not doing that on game day. That's all up to them. So we should be developing their ability to do that.
Yeah, the only time I jumped in was free throws. That was roughly where my athletic ability...
And that was rebounding.
It was. It's really interesting, the delivery of the message to a player, though, because there are times where it can be a really positive message, but delivered in such a highly volatile environment, it can come across, like if you were sitting on the other side of this and watching a delivery of a message from the grandstand, it can be easily misconstrued as well. So it's the whole, and I know Zoe said it a couple of times, it's listen to the message, not the delivery of it. So the body language of the coach as well, and how they, you know, is it a spray across the court, but the only way that they can hear you is to be able to yell across a court. So it can come across as something really volatile. Is there any sort of advice you can give to coaches as to how they can best deliver it so that it doesn't look demonstrative and it can almost put players at ease to be able to hear the message and not look at the potentially crazy coach on the sideline?
Right. I think there is an easy answer to this one.
Yep.
And I think it's film yourself.
Yep.
So many coaches don't know what they look like when they're giving praise and they actually look like they're about to pop some blood vessels. Like if you're giving a positive message and you're looking like that, well, firstly, so in junior sport, obviously parents are such a huge part of that. You want to have, you know, a good presentation to your parents that you're not ripping their kids' heads off every time they do something well. If you might have, maybe you have to edit this language out, but if you have a resting bitch face as a coach, then you need to know about that. And the only way really to do that, other than getting feedback from your other coaches, is to film yourself. So lots of coaches film games. I would challenge you to film, just have a parent with a video camera filming you as a coach throughout the game. Have a look at what you look like during timeouts. If you can get a camera close enough so that you can hear what you're saying as well, hugely important as well. So I think developing an awareness is the easy solution to that, but also developing that ability as a coach to self-regulate throughout the game. And if you know that you're getting worked up and a couple of things have gone wrong in a row, maybe just take a step backwards off the bench for a quarter of a second, grab a swig of water, have a breath, anything, whatever your process is to reset. Like, that is easy to say right now, like sitting on a chair in an office, but often in the course of a game, that's not as easy to do. So, but it's important to consider if you can.
That used to be mine. I used to take a drink of water when I was starting to get irate. Then I realized my bottle size went from like a 600 mil to a 1.25 to a 2 liter bottle. And I'm walking in with like a massive camel bag for the next session.
With one of those big jugs that they have in offices.
I may need to review this.
Coach, yeah.
I need to review my actions at this point before I start walking in with like the water cooler from the office on the sidelines.
They'll just plummet into the bench for you next time. Exactly. Never
need to fly. Is there a difference between player feedback and player instruction in particular? So it's one thing to deliver feedback to players, but it's coaches. We want to have an impact on the game, so we'll call the next offense or whatever the case may be. Is there a difference between the two and how the two need to be delivered?
Yeah, so instruction and feedback, if you look at it from a technical kind of research point of view, yes, they're different. Instruction is something that happens before an event, and feedback is something that happens after an event. So we're talking about feedback. That's kind of a continuous cycle throughout a game. But instruction, I mean, you can think of it as what happens pre-game. So your pre-game spiel, you know, here are three players that I want you guys to watch. Here's our first set. Here's how we're going to draw up, playing against the zone. That's all your instruction before a game. So I think it's important with that pre-game work not to make that too much of a lecture. Like, that needs to be a two-way process as well. So it's similar to feedback. Like, you want to give your athletes some ownership. So you might get a player to come up and draw, okay, sweet. So if they go into a 2-3 zone, what are we running? Like, give us some of those kind of zone offenses that we've got. Okay, baseline out of bounds, like, what are we running? Like, first time we get one of those. Whatever you might be setting your players up for. I think that's like that instructional process can often be seen as my job as the coach, right? So we've got to draw it all up because we need to make it look like we know what we're doing. We don't want our players questioning, you know, whether we're knowledgeable about the game. And that's something I fell into as a rookie coach for sure. Like, oh, look at all this stuff I know, guys, like drawing all the X's and O's up on the board. But it doesn't matter if I know that stuff or not. It's what the players are going to do. So your instruction, I think you need to take a similar approach with your feedback. I think basketball as well is quite a different kettle of fish to footy in that you're right there on the sideline. You can't call plays from 100 metres away, three levels up at Etihad Stadium or Marvel or whatever it is this week. But in a basketball game, you're right there. The players can hear you. You can call plays. You can adjust things on the fly. You can give that instruction. But, I mean, generally speaking, I think less is more. I think the less we do, the better. But that's going to depend on your stage of development of your athletes, how long you've had them, is it a new system? I don't feel like you can't say anything because I don't want that to be the message that comes out of this. Like, don't just sit on your hands and stay silent the whole time because that's going to be a negative outcome too.
Yeah, I think a really important or useful when I changed the way I coached and had, if we saw, say, they were in a switching man and we were struggling hard with it, we'd call a timeout. And something that really became useful for me was saying, right, what are they doing to us? And they'd say, they're switching. So what do we do? I'll find the mismatch. And okay, cool. You know, why did I have to blow this time out? But over the course of the season, and again, this is with seniors, so I think it can be scaled to ages, but, you know, I don't think you're going to get an under 14 team, you know, aware that they're going to be jump switching on the left-hand side of the floor and then, you know, pack line on the right. Like, I don't know, but, you know, it's, I think it can be scaled down. It's all relative. But if you can across the course of the season, I then didn't have to ask those questions because they started to then huddle in there on the court. Hey, they're switching. We should do this. Or, hey, they're, you know, zoning on a score, man on a miss, or whatever it might be. And they then started to make those adjustments. So then we could worry about more important things. And I think that, again, as you said, it starts to make you become a little redundant, but that's the aim, right? Like, they're the ones that play the game, not us. So we need them in a position to be able to, you know, the keys are in their hands and off they go, and then they win games and you look great.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you can kind of sit there thinking that your job is done, not because you've ridden them within an inch of their lives, but because you've developed them over the course. I think it was John Wooden. It's normally John Wooden.
Probably is.
Usually is, yeah.
who said that all of his work is what happens during the week, and the game on the weekend, or where whatever the schedule was in the States in the 70s, 80s, you know, that's when the exam comes, right? So you're the teacher, you're preparing them through the semester, but the exam comes along, you can't be there. So that's when you get them to show off what they know. And I think you make a great point, Zoe, that it develops over time. It's not something you can just throw them into. I remember making this mistake with a warm-up that I might have done with a certain youth league team at a certain Big V club. Some great Siebel coaches. I won't name them, but I think they were, I think it was Rob and Zoe.
Yeah. Zoe and Rob, thanks.
Yeah. Yes, correct.
Taking order.
Sorry, you're appearing left to right on my screen, but I should draw in order of importance. and I remember saying to one of my players, hey, we've done this warm-up enough times, like, you guys know what you're doing. And they went, yeah, right, go and run it and show them what we've been doing. And it didn't work because we hadn't prepared them enough for it. And so it's really important. You need to scale it over the course of the season. You can't do it cold turkey.
So when we look at preparing athletes in that situation, we've all heard of the VARC model of understanding and educating, and so to speak. Is that the best model for getting players to understand and in that situation preparing them for it? Like, what's the balance of, say, film versus written scout versus audible scout versus just kind of work it out and then we'll make adjustments on the fly? Like, where does it sit for you guys, and is that different to basketball as well?
So the whole learning styles thing, the visual, auditory, that kind of stuff, is getting canned at the moment in the research world, because what it does is forces people into a fixed mindset about what they are as a learner. So, oh, no, I'm not going to listen to the coach because I'm a visual learner. I'll wait for him to draw it up. And so you get these athletes in fixed mindsets based on what they've been told as their preferred learning style. They might still have preferences for how they learn, and that's super important to consider because that affects their motivation for engaging with what you're saying or teaching or drawing. But, you know, it's very hard in a squad of 40-odd players, as we have at the moment, it's very hard to cater for all of those learning styles, you know, and differentiate for them. So I think the best practical advice for a coach that doesn't have all the time in the world is to try and touch on all of them and offer a smorgasbord, if you like, a tasting plate of different methods of accessing something. So don't feel like you have to sit down, test all your players. Oh, you're a visual learner. Good. So we'll do this. I don't want to say a scattergun approach because that sounds a little bit kind of unplanned, but it's a mixture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, athletes that are, you know, potentially auditory or kinesthetic or whatever it might be, they still need to be able to read something off a whiteboard. So, like, that's a skill. And so we can't just throw that out and say, oh, well, they're not read right. So, you know, it's okay that they can't do that. If you want to get to the next level, if you want to be high performance or even just, you know, play at a senior level, you know, that could be youth league, that could be Big V, could be NBL 1, whatever it might be, you need to be able to read off a whiteboard. So, yeah, I think trying to develop those skills, like, is it a thing that, say, if you are a visual learner, do you have the ability to, I guess, work on the other skills and get to a point where that is at a reasonable level?
Yeah, totally. I think the reason that people feel like they're not as good at the other stuff is that they shut their minds off to the idea of still being okay with that stuff. Like, just because you're a visual learner doesn't mean you can't read a novel, or, you know, just because you're kinesthetic doesn't mean you can't sit down and watch some film and still kind of get that stuff out of it. So it's really just being open-minded in your approach. I don't want to give too much kind of heavy research stuff, but there's this really interesting study that happened a few years ago where they tested kids in a classroom about their best learning style. And then they taught them some content in that learning style, and then they gave them all a final test. And it didn't matter whether they matched the student to their preferred learning style or gave them some random other learning style. It didn't predict how they did on the test. So by actually catering for the different learning styles, it's for the effort that it takes, it's not actually having that much of an outcome. So I think moving away from learning styles and into preferences or things that, I mean, it might still be things that athletes think they find easier, but to label them as visual or read-write or whatever it might be, I think that's where the damage is being done. And so I think that we need to, we need to encourage people to open their minds to, you're not just a visual learner. Just because you might say you're a visual learner, maybe you don't find it as easy to read-write, but it's still something that you can do and you can work on. So, yeah, use it or lose it.
Yeah,
I've got some work to do this afternoon. I've got some slides to change for some courses. It turns out now, but that's okay. Like it's not a problem. It's a great point.
You still need to know. I still think you need to know what their preference is. So not what type of learner they are, what their preference is. See, I'm learning already.
Yeah,
and I'm not an auditory learner. Boom. But I think it's important to know what their preferences are to be able to create, especially with junior athletes, create that level of comfort in learning and thirst for learning too. So if everything's hard all the time, you know, and it's, you know, it's confusing all the time or difficult all the time, then kids are eventually going to go, you know what, I'm not really into this. So I think knowing their preferences is still very important, but spot on about, you know, there are other elements that they're going to have to work on, just like they have to work on their shot, just like they have to work on ball handling. They have to learn how to take some feedback or take an instruction from a coach and then put it into play, read off the whiteboard, put it into play. You know, you can't always, you know, oh, I'm in a timeout. Okay, five of you on the court, can you run through this? This is the baseline we're going to run, and then go out and run it, you know. So but yeah, from a development point of view, understanding what their preference is, I think is important, so you can sort of skew that to their learning and ensure that they're still having success. And then, working on that, challenging them with those other styles to help them become a more holistic athlete.
I think that's an excellent point you raised, Zoe. It's important for them to experience success. And so if they, if they look at something on the board and then they understand it and they go and put it in practice in a game, they're going to get confidence. Mm-hmm. So the study I was talking about before, that's very much based on an educational outcome. It's how much did you learn, but it's not motivational. And we need to have our players motivated and engaged. And I mean, I had the pleasure of watching you coach at Don Valley there for that season, and I saw the way that you, like, you tailored your message for the individual. And I think that's hugely important because, and it, again, it's so closely related to teaching. Like, the first professional standard for teachers is know students and how they learn. And so over the course of the season, watching you develop those relationships with your players, you could see the way that you would approach, pulling one player across after they've just been subbed out versus a different player. You've got to be able to tailor that message, tailor the tone that you use, and tailor the amount of feedback that you give. And I think good coaches do that intuitively. Like, what I'm saying right now is not revolutionary. Good coaches are already doing it. So it's super important.
How do you go in that situation, given you guys have to use a runner for a lot of your feedback? Is there any concern that sometimes, it's like Chinese whispers, like the message that goes down may not be the message that gets out there? And it's very similar in basketball, where we may call a point guard across and say, you need to deliver this message, or the sub comes in through the bench and you need to go and deliver this message. Is there any concerns about maybe the message doesn't always get through or interpreted the right way when it's delivered?
Yeah, totally. That phrase, Chinese whispers, is completely what happens. And you've got this chain of communication where it's either an assistant or the head coach up in the coach's box, on the phone, down to the bench. They might not even talk directly to the runner. They might talk to the bench coach. I mean, some clubs at the moment use their head coach on the bench. Some clubs use like a senior assistant. But then that might then go to the runner and then to the player. So unfortunately, in a game, we're prevented from putting mics on the runner for research purposes because the AFL, you know, wants to keep control of all the IP and all the licensing, copyright stuff, yep. etc. It would be so good to track a message from start to finish and see, like, often you see a runner on, if you watch a footy game on TV, you see the runner kind of, you know, they've got their 30 seconds after a centre bounce to run out. They tap the player on the bum and you might hear them whisper something. It might be two words, but prior to that, the coach was on the phone to the runner for like 2 minutes trying to get a message across. And you think, which words did he say? Yeah. So super important and to consider that. And I think one of the ways we can ensure that the Chinese whispers doesn't happen as much is through consistent and shared terminology. So everyone's in the meeting where you introduce your new concepts. If someone's away one training and you introduce this idea of icing a screen, then when they come back in the next time, you can talk to them about it, get the other players. Okay, what did we learn about icing a screen last time? You can have everyone on the same page so that on a game day, when you hear, you might pull your point guard over and say, hey, we want to do X, Y, and Z. They're on the same page. They've heard that term before. It's all consistent.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Is there any concern that if you are addressing a whole group of players in particular, if you single someone out for individual feedback, that the rest of the group stops listening and it's like, oh, look, if you're talking to Zoe over there, that's not relevant to me, so I'm just going to check out. And then you're going to try and get their engagement again and things like that. How do you manage that situation?
Yeah, that's so tough. It depends on the size of your group as well. Like if you've got five, you've probably got more chance of keeping their attention. But if you've got, you know, a larger squad, if you're addressing 12 or maybe, you know, you're at the start of a preseason and you haven't cut anyone yet and you've got like 15, 20, that can get really challenging. So I think that's, again, the art of coaching. You've got to be able to, if it's something that's general enough that, you know, maybe all the wing players would benefit from hearing it, even if it's directed at one, go for it. But I think otherwise, yeah, that's probably an individual conversation for afterwards. Like the last thing you want to do is, all right, guys, just hold on and then spend the next 5 minutes kind of discussing one-on-one. So player attention is limited and you want to, if you consider it a pool of money that you've got at the start of your session, you don't want to go spending it all in the first 5 or 10 minutes and then be broke for the rest of the time, having lost their attention. So, yeah.
So what's the best way to get their attention?
What was that?
What's the best way to get their attention?
Loud banging and breaking your clipboard on the bench. No, I wouldn't do that at all. Yeah. Getting their attention. So, say, for example, in the timeout, getting their attention. I think, so there's some really interesting, here I go again about research, but there's some really interesting studies on how physical exertion affects memory. And so something we've implemented with different teams has been giving them the first 10 seconds to get a drink and sit down and get their breath. Because if you blow a timeout and you're already barking at them as they're walking to the bench, they're going to be going, whoa, what just happened? They're processing stuff. Give them a little bit of time. I think that takes a little bit of patience and self-awareness on the coach's behalf. But I think that making sure they're ready is probably an important first step. Obviously, don't take that to the extreme and, guys, just chill out. We're going to play some Enya and we're going to take you through a breathing exercise and then you don't actually get to talk to them. But yeah. Find that sweet spot. It'll be different for, you know, whether they're, you know, under 12s, under 18s, yeah. Whatever it might be.
The break is really important. I also think a cue to lock in is also, you know, so and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but something I always used to say whenever I was starting a timeout and, you know, using the board, it's like, okay, eyes here, and that was like, okay, I'm starting, so listen now, or, you know, make a mistake and out you come. No. but it was almost like, so, and again, senior level, it's a lot easier. There's a lot more time. There's, you know, all those sort of things. But it was always go over to Rob. He'd always have the whiteboard for me, which was great. Get a couple of points off of him. And in that time, they've had that time to just sit, chill, get their drink bottle. And then it's in we come, eyes here, and now we go. Not always successful, but probably more successful than less. So, you know, and, you know, I'm not coaching now at the moment, but, you know, just trial and error with some of that stuff and you find what works for you. I know, I think it's Jack Fleming has listen up or listen here or something like that, which is his cue to, okay, I'm ready to talk now, and gets the kids, you know, locked in and it's ready to go. So, yeah, whatever's comfortable, but I think a little cue to all right, I'm starting, because there might be an athlete still looking for their drink bottle or whatever it might be, and they don't know you're ready to talk yet. So, and then they hear that, it's like, oh, well, I've lost my chance to get a drink, and they come back in and start listening. So I think, yeah, that could be helpful to some coaches.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you mentioned there a phrase, it's what works for you. And so I think, I mean, I can talk about what I've seen at senior level, but if you're listening in and you're coaching under 12s, some of this stuff won't work just by virtue of the athletes that you're coaching. Yeah. So I think in basketball and in all sports, we can be guilty of falling into a trap of going, cool, here's this really great method that this college coach in America uses. Let's use that. And like, they might be running certain offenses. Are you going to run those with your under 12s? Of course not. So why are you going to instruct in the same way with 19, 20-year-olds as you would with 10, 11-year-olds? Yeah. So exactly, it's what works for you. If your under 12s like that 10 seconds to go and get the drink bottle, sit down, all right, eyes on me. Yeah. If that works, fantastic. Yeah. Don't feel like you have to follow a framework that's come from, you know, a coach of a college team from 1986, because it might not work for you. You've got to do that kind of groundwork yourself. And that's where, as a coach, you have to be almost like a scientist, right? Try different things, check the outcome. If it doesn't work, change the things that you're trying and see how that affects the outcome.
Yeah, for sure.
How much information do you think players can take in at a timeout or a quarter time, half time type break? So we'll assume we'll go for a minute with a timeout, quarter time, similar sort of time. Half time, you get a little bit longer. How much can you really control and impact in that situation before they just, they're lost? And some players will obviously be better than others, but I know some coaches that almost script their first 5 or 10 possessions. It's like, I've forgotten after 4. Like, how the heck are the players able to remember what's going on in that situation? So how much can they actually consume and then go and implement?
Less than you would think. And that's a scary thought. As a coach, you think, oh, I've got like 7 points that I need them to hear. A great analogy that I heard from a rugby coach, I got to spend some time with an NRL coach earlier in the year, and he's a really good thinker in this space. And he said, if I throw you 10 tennis balls, how many are you going to catch?
Nice. Yep.
You might catch 2. If you've got big hands, you might catch 3, but there's no chance you're going to grab 10 if they're all in the air at the same time. And so great metaphor for the instruction that you're giving is keep it to those 2 or 3 key points. If you're getting thrown 2 eggs and 8 tennis balls, you're wanting to catch the egg. You don't want to mess. So those 2 important points are the ones that you want to be catching. Maybe just throw those 2 instead of all the noise that comes in at the same time. Did a study with a couple of football players where we sat in their Monday review meeting where they got the one-on-one footage kind of session between the player and the coach. A week later, I interviewed them and said, how much of that did you remember? I want you to recall everything that the coach said. Somewhere between 10 and 50%.
Yeah.
And that's pretty standard, whether you're a senior, potentially a little bit less if you're junior, depending on the stage of the athlete's development, the complexity of the message. I would be prioritizing 1 or 2 big things rather than trying to put out spot fires, because I think they'll remember less than you think they'll remember. But until you've actually checked that by questioning, you won't know. If it's 100%, awesome. Right. But you won't know unless you've asked.
So would you suggest that players are more likely to remember something that's relative to them or that means something to them rather than something fairly general? So if we're talking, does the point guard need to know the center's scout? Well, in some cases, yes, because they are a one dribble to the middle. We can double on that and potentially make them pass. How valuable is it for the wing to know that when they're potentially not going to be the person that goes and traps in that?
Yeah, that's another tough one. And like in a footy environment, it's interesting as well, because you've got an offense coach, a defense coach, and a contest coach. And so they've all got their 3 important points, right? And then you get into the team meeting and suddenly you've got 9 important points. And these tennis balls were manageable before, but now I'm getting rained on. It's hard. Again, there's no easy answer on that one. I think if it's a need to know, then it's got to go out. It's also something you can probably introduce to training during the week, so it's not brand new stuff on game day. The more times they have exposure to that information, the more likely they are to remember it. So if you introduce it on a Tuesday, you recap it on a Thursday or Sunday, Wednesday, whatever your weekly setup might be, I think you're setting them up for success a little bit better there.
Yeah, awesome. Is there a concern of that paralysis by analysis with players as well? Like, I know coaches certainly feel it, but we have so many fantastic players in basketball and AFL that just simply play on instinct. And it's almost like they're cerebral and how they move and how they read what's going on. Are there some players that you sort of sit there and say, look, I don't want to give you this information because it will really detract from what they're good at in the first place?
Definitely. I think in theory, all players, we need to think of all players like that. We don't want to constrain them too much with information that will bog them down, make them throw a pass half a second later because they're thinking, oh, what did the coach say about, you know, should that go? Like, should I drop that into the forward or should I kick to the wing? You want to, I think that the philosophy is, and we talk about kind of a game-based approach to coaching or a constraints-led approach to coaching, you need to put players in the situations in training where they're going to have to make those decisions for themselves, be exposed to exactly what they'll see in a game, rather than doing lots of one-on-one, 5-on-0 breakdown drills. So in theory, you shouldn't need to instruct because they have experienced that exact situation in a game before. Potentially they've experienced, in training before. They've potentially also experienced a harder situation in training before. If you're playing, say, 4-on-6, for example, you want to have an overload for the defense and really put some chaos in there. Being able to make all those decisions without having to think too much about it is, I think, gold standard and what we're starting to move towards. But it's going to take a long time to change the culture of trying to, you know, every time the ball goes here, we need to trap and then whatever happens here. Obviously, there's still an element of that that needs to occur, especially in basketball where you've got so few players on the court. But if you've got 18 on the field, you're going to be hard-pressed to run a play like that that's really heavily instructed. So, yeah, create thinking players through setting up training really cleverly so they can experience it.
And it's even, you know, if you're talking a scout, for instance, like we had an athlete last year, we were coming into a finals game and she was going to have to play on a player that is just – you know, Opal's level, but prefers right hand all the time. You know, if you can take that out, she's so good on her right that we can't afford it.
Yeah.
We were lucky enough to have 2 weeks lead into that. And so when we were doing our scrimmage or in any drill, that athlete that we chose for the scout and anybody that was on her or could have potentially been on her had to send everyone left. The whole time. And we didn't tell them why. We just, you know, this is what you're doing. This is what. So then when it got time to the game, it was like, hey, you're just doing what you did at practice for the last 2 weeks. And that we found that then allowed more space for more information, more important information, and also more information for her to be successful at the offensive end. Because I think sometimes we can throw scout and throw information and on the other team or other players or whatever it might be, and it takes away from, because they're so locked in on trying to get that done, it takes away from, again, what makes them great and what they can contribute, because, you know, every waking second they're thinking about, oh, I can't let her go right, I can't let her do that, I've got to box this out, I've got to do that, I've got to do, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, that's really, really good, you're doing a great job, but how about some points at the other end, you know, it's like you can shoot the three. So I think, yeah, setting them up like that can really sort of help and again allow more information that becomes almost unconscious, and then you can put in the conscious information that you want them to have or need them to have.
Yeah, definitely. I love that idea of sending left in training for 2 weeks. That's brilliant. I think you can even structure that into your scrimmages by going, okay, if you allow them to score on the right, that means their layup's worth 5 points. Yep. If they score on the left, it's just 2. So you can end up shaping behavior by changing the rules of the game so that, you know, you're not giving up any points on, because you're going to blow out if you let, you know, you let 5 points in, or, you know, you let 5 buckets in on a right hand, suddenly you're down by an awful lot more than you should be. So, yeah, rewarding that behavior in training, I think you're right. It then frees up a little more instruction on game day. But then that other point that you mentioned, I want to pick up on as well, because yes, we can be super conscious of the opponent and lose the focus on ourselves. And I've seen that in footy, I've seen that in basketball, and it is paralysis by analysis, I think. I think if you have a really good, solid set of principles, you should be able to adapt them slightly depending on what your opponent's throwing at you, but you're still playing your brand. I think that's a really fine line that as coaches we have to sometimes live and die by, but yeah, it's important to take into consideration.
And it also comes through a bit of trial and error. Like you don't you don't just automatically know where that balance is. You've got to have a go at it, see what works, see what doesn't. And, you know, especially for junior coaches, you know, if it means that you end up losing a game, that's okay. Like, because you're developing you, you're developing your teaching method for your, which will then eventually be what's best for the athletes and help them develop. So I would say don't be afraid to trial and error all of this. And, you know, if a lot of the time coaches are worried about, you know, what parents might think if they're losing games and things like that, be completely honest about what you're trying to do. And I think any parent that hears that you're trying to develop yourself to help develop their child, I think nine and a half times out of 10, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get a good response to that.
Yeah, definitely. That's so important to think about development versus performance. Like, what kind of, you know, short-term gains are you happy giving up to get the long-term outcome? And if you look at a basketball program from under 12s to all the way through to seniors, I reckon any director of coaching is going to be happy with dropping a few games at that under 12s level in order to develop players that A, are better skilled, B, are better decision makers, and C, are enjoying their basketball more because they can see themselves getting better. So I think it's an easy argument to make. And of course, it's difficult at times, you know, you lose a game that you could have won, but yeah, a long-term approach, same with politics, isn't it? You know, these one-term cycles and you never get any kind of long-term progress, but that's probably another podcast.
Yeah. We'll get you in for the political hour down the road somewhere. I mean, obviously, there's two main types of training in regard to like block training and like games approach training and constraints and small-sided games. Is there one over the other that you find feedback relates to the players better in those situations where they're working on a skill in isolation versus when they're working in something they'll potentially see in a game?
Good question. I've just been teaching some of this kind of game training design type stuff to some second year PE students, and they're finding it really interesting to reflect on their own junior sport or their own experience with sport at school. And it's that linear model of, okay, we're going to practice the skill, and then we're going to get some feedback. And then at the end, if you're good, we're going to play a game, but only if you're good. And then we get through all of our skill stuff. It's like the ice cream at the end of the broccoli, right? So I think moving towards this game-based or a constraints-led approach, you're letting the game do the teaching a lot of the time, so that you need to do less giving of feedback verbally, because the game's able to provide some inbuilt feedback. So, you know, if you're giving up 5 points for every right-handed layup, then that's feedback to stop doing it, you know? Yeah. You're giving up an awful lot of points every time that happens. So
make an adjustment.
You don't actually then need to say, you know, stop doing that, because the scoreboard is telling that to you. So, you can free up your voice by in building that feedback to a really clever training design.
Yep. And how much player feedback do you allow as well during your set? Because, I mean, there are times where obviously your coach isn't able to go and deliver the feedback directly, but do you encourage players to give feedback to each other? And is there a preferred method of that? Because sometimes it has to be so short and sharp that you don't get much of a chance. You get the two words, like we spoke about before. Is there anything you guys have designed around that?
Yeah, so the player-to-player feedback thing is massive, and I don't think it's considered enough in any sport at any level, but there are some really important things that you need in place first. And I think one of them is getting rid of this idea of, as point guards in a squad, you're all competing against each other to get that starting spot, which of course it's always going to be there, but it needs to be that growth mindset culture of, I can get feedback from a peer about, you know, you threw that pass and I like call my name so I know it's coming, because I'm, you know, running my butt off to get down and bounce off the baseline or whatever it might be. So you need to create that culture where it's okay to do that, because the last thing you want to do is be like, cool, I want to teach really well, we're going to get peer feedback, and then you've just got infighting in your squad because everyone's just trying to one-up each other and saying, I did that better than you. So that's kind of the first thing. But I think it's important because, as you say, you can't get out there some of the time. You might need to run a message through another player. So it's important to build their capacity to give feedback to each other. You might try getting them to analyze other teams, for example. That way it's not personalized. You can sit down and watch some film of another team and go, okay, what feedback would you give to this player off that last play? Develop their capacity to analyze and be able to deliver feedback without that kind of potential for personal sting in there. It's something you need to kind of monitor yourself as well, and make sure that, you know, the terminology is right. And then, you know, if the players are starting to use different language for a certain concept or a certain action, that you reflect that as well, because you don't want to be talking about different things. So lots of moving parts, but I think it can have, like, you get a good return on investment, I think, if you can develop that culture.
I think too, if you've created that culture, you've also then got to back the player that is brave enough to do it.
Yeah,
so if
sure.
if a player has, you know, stepped up and has delivered some feedback to another player, and that other player hasn't taken it so well, you got to back the player that's, you know, unless it's, you know, profanity and, you know, like derogatory and all that sort of stuff. Like, there's obviously a line, but if you're going to create that culture, is, you know, we've had it before with athletes, because we feel that a peer-driven team will be far more successful than a coach-driven team. So if they're holding each other accountable, that's going to mean so much more than us coming in and growling like mum and dad, and, you know, they just end up switching off to us. So, and we had an example of it where an athlete, you know, she stepped up, she said it, you know, probably went a little too far. The other athlete didn't take it all that well and looked straight at us, and we just stayed neutral with our body language, neutral with our feedback, you know, just, yeah, get it done. And then it was at a different time saying, hey, I love that you're doing it. We need to skew this message and the way that we deliver it, because think about if I said that like that to you, how would you take that? And she's like, oh, I probably wouldn't like it. I'm like, right. So there you go. And then she became one of our, like, almost like a coach on court. You know, she was able, a lot of the stuff we didn't end up having to say because she said it for us. So, but had either of us had pulled her aside and said, no, that's wrong, you know, it's unacceptable, blah, 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 she would have gone back into her shell, and we would have lost that almost ally that we ended up having on the floor. And so, you have to, it was uncomfortable to, I'll be honest, it was uncomfortable to be able to stand by it, because I saw it and I thought, oh, Jesus, that's that's gone too far. But in that second it was, hey, you know, we've got to try and open this up to allow these, and we'll just adjust how we go from there. It's hard to do. Like, I struggled with it in that moment. So, yeah, like, don't, again, I sound like I'm preaching a little bit, but don't be afraid to, you know, fix things after the fact if you need to, you know, for the sake of the culture that you're trying to create. And don't be afraid to, if you look back on it at the end, like, if I looked back on it at the end and went, oh, nah, I should have said something in that moment, admit that to your group, admit that to your athlete. Like, you know, it's okay to be a bit vulnerable and be a bit, hey, I made that error, because that will then, you know, endear them to you a little bit more and help with trust and help with that relationship of, no, you're not just always going to sit here and tell me you're right even though I know you're wrong.
Yeah, there's a lot of shelving egos and there's a lot of relationship rebuilding if you go down this path. Yeah. And I think, yeah, you end up developing this common understanding that there might be a couple of harsh little bits and pieces that happen during a game, but at the quarter break, you go over, you slap them a high five, or you elbow bump, as we seem to be doing more of at the minute, and you repair the relationship. Because, yeah. I mean, you can look at feedback as something that happens at the self level, like, you're really good, but what we really want to do is remove the self level stuff and make it task level, like, talk about the task, remove anything that's related to their worth as a person, their talent as a basketballer, keep it focused on, I think keeping it future focused too. Here's what you can do next time. Not, you just sprayed that shot, I don't want you taking any more three-pointers. It's okay, next time you get that shot, I want you to evaluate it. I want you to think a little more about it, or maybe let's look at some other options.
Yeah.
Think towards the future.
So when you, I mean, you spend some time in the coach's box, obviously, and I'm certainly not asking you to sell your head coach down the river here. We want you to stay in
employment. Give us all your secrets.
Please don't do that. But how, valuable is it to almost be removed from that sideline where you can say anything in the safety of a commentary box or a coach's box, so to speak, that no other player can hear? And sometimes you do just need to vent, it almost feels like. You just need to get it out quickly. It's short, it's sharp, it's delivered. It doesn't have any impact on that as well. Like, how important is that for coaches?
Yeah, you've always got to blow off some steam. It doesn't matter. You could be the Zen master, but I'm sure, you know, Phil Jackson did a lot of meditation and incense stuff and all of that, but I'm sure he lost his cool a couple of times. And it's, yeah, you're right. You're a lot more public doing that on a basketball court than you are off in a nicely air-conditioned room that's also mostly soundproof but not soundproof in key moments. Yeah, coaches like blowing off steam at times, and that's happened. I mean, I've spent some time with another club briefly before Port Adelaide, and I know that it happened. Like, it's a common thing across football, obviously basketball as well, plenty of sports. There needs to be a filter between what you're blowing off steam about and what ends up going down as a message. So there's often some benefits seen to having a little lag time in between the event happening and then you actually sending the message, just, all right, composed, what's our message got to be? Because if you get straight on the phone and bark it down, that can, and you've seen, I mean, I've seen a couple of examples of, I think it came up on the footy show a couple of times back when that was a thing. And it was this footage of a player hearing a message on the phone, and then it cuts to the coach's box and you see the coach with the jugular popping, yeah. And then it cuts back down to the player and the player's just like pulling the phone away from his ear because he's getting blasts and his eardrums are not going so well. The message needs to be clear and it needs to be effective, and if you can take some emotion out of it before it actually gets down to the player, that's again, it's the art of coaching, and it's not something that happens immediately, but with plenty of reflection and plenty of practice, you can get it.
Because there are really different types of talk as well. I mean, there is the venting, obviously. There's a little bit of commentary that I find myself doing a fair bit on the time. Good, you've made the pass, now what? And you know, like, good pass, like, happy with that. Now what's the next decision? But then there's the actual instruction that comes after that, and it's trying to find a way to have, if you are having that commentary, is it constructive commentary? Like, are you now talking yourself into what the actionable item is going to be after that? Because, and it's difficult to do. Sometimes you'll talk to your assistant coach, sometimes you're mulling it over in your head, and the only way you can get it out is to sort of verbalise it, hear it, and go, geez, I don't like how that sounds. I've got to reevaluate this as well. Like what's the best method for getting the clearest outcome, I suppose, from a coaching end?
I think, yeah, firstly, it's being aware of exactly what you just mentioned. Like, there are different layers to your messaging or your verbal output during a game, and at that lower level it's barracking, it's commentary, it's the stuff that you're kind of riding the game, and you're a coach, you're not BT, you're not a sideline play-by-play commentator, so it's obviously going to happen from time to time because coaching is a very passionate endeavor, and that's okay. But moving up to those higher levels, you're doing things like identifying problems or helping players to identify problems. And then once you've got your problem identified, it's working towards a solution. And they're the kind of bigger ticket items that are going to get you bang for buck. So just being aware that your thinking and your voice in coaching exists on a continuum, and that you need to start being aware of where you are on that continuum. Are you a barracker? Are you a commentator? Are you a problem identifier? Are you a problem solver? Again, it comes back to reflection and awareness. And I think I mentioned it before, take footage of yourself as a coach, awesome audio. I know you mentioned Jack Fleming before. I had a really interesting conversation with him a few weeks ago, and he's saying he's got a GoPro on his chest for all of his timeouts and he's listening back. I think that's a great idea. Obviously, we've only got a certain number of hours in the day, but you're going to find out pretty quickly whether you're a barracker or you're a problem solver once that footage hits your screen.
Yeah, the commentary or the barracker can also, it's really easy to do that in your younger levels, age groups, yep. Like your under 12s and below, because you've worked on things and you're trying to pump them up and you're trying to get them to dribble with their non-preferred hand. You're trying to get them to shoot actual layups as opposed to coming to the stop and all those sort
just
of things.
Just have fun and enjoy
it. Yeah. And so it's really easy to slip into that. What can then tend to happen that I've noticed is then you're starting to prescribe the game for the athletes. So we've all seen an athlete takes off and we hear from the coach, pass it. And by the time the athlete sees who they're supposed to pass to and passes it, that pass is no longer there. It's now a turnover. And the athlete's,
Why'd you throw that turnover?
Yeah, well, yeah. So I think, it's super hard. I've coached under 12s before and I was definitely a barracker and I gave them far too much information during the game. If I had my time again, I wouldn't do that. But, you know, trying to find the balance at that level is tough of how do I keep this fun, help them find a level of success, but also help them learn the game, let the game be the teacher, like you mentioned, and learn through discovery and things like that. It's, whoever can get that at an under 12 level, good grief, they're going to be creating some athletes. You know, I think it's something to be mindful of if you are at those levels and, you know, if like what Bubble's doing, you know, putting the GoPro on them, I think is a huge plus for any coach at those sort of age groups and levels.
Yeah, totally. And that's a really important point again about, you know, the under 12s coach. If you're listening to this and you're coaching under 12s, please don't feel like you can't be a barracker at times. Yeah. Like, it's so important to celebrate success.
For sure.
Your player just scores a left-handed layup for the first time in their career. I'm hoping to see on that GoPro footage just jumping up and down and being happy for them, because that's so important as well. So don't feel like there's a time and a place for everything. And the last thing I want to do is give people the impression that barracking is always bad. So, that's a really good point. Yeah.
But where we see it, I suppose, the most is when you instill offense. And that does happen at under 12 level, because the vast majority of, I suppose, of coaches would use that sort of five-out motion, just pass, cut, replace it, which is fine. But the great irony of that is you are still teaching an offense. Like, you're not actually teaching your players to read a whole lot. They're just, you're ingraining in them pass, cut, replace. And we've seen the coaches that are literally on the side, and it's almost like 2K. Like, they hit the button, they have to pass, and then they have to cut, and then they have to replace around. But it's teaching your players to learn and read what is going on in front of them, because not all coach-driven feedback towards players has to be verbal. Like, you can just put them in a situation where it's like, are you going to be denied here? Well, you go and check. Like, go out there, and if you get denied, what do you think you should do? And leading them down the path a little bit of, you make the decision. I'll give you some hints, but you make the decision.
Yeah, it's important to be happy with mess as a coach, right? Like, you need for them to be able to stuff it up every now and then. And as you said, maybe they will get denied on that pass. So, cool. That's not an option anymore. What's your plan B? You see so many teams run all the way to the very end of their offense, even though they're giving up like a beautiful open lane and they're giving up like the cutters open on the back door. And no. We've got a really good offense. We're getting all the way to the end. I want you guys to see the final action because it's great. Like, no, encourage them to explore and to, you know, find the solutions to the problems that happen at each point of that offense, so that when you come across the team that's like really like they're setting up really high and they're denying all of those wing passes, you're able to exploit that and do something different instead. And that doesn't happen through drawing that on a whiteboard. That happens through running through that in training and experiencing it 5-on-5, I think.
So is there any benefit, this is one without notice, so I apologize there, is there any benefit to doing things like 5-on-0?
Yes, I think there is. A really interesting, a really good guy, researcher by the name of Carl Woods, who I've worked with at Port, he's a skill acquisition scientist. And he calls things like that, or things like, you know, passing lines where you're just kind of going backwards and forwards, junk food drills, because they don't have an awful lot of nutritional value, but they're feel good and they help you to, I don't know. I mean, at the start of the session, you might want to try it for 5 minutes, and then that helps players to feel comfortable. So you can then expose them more to the mess once you get into the 5-on-5. So often, and it's the same with things like asking questions and, you know, doing different drills at training. Sometimes it's more for your benefit as a coach than for the players. You might ask a question like, do we all understand that? Like I mentioned before, and everyone goes, yes, that's a question for you as a coach to feel better that you reckon they know. 5-on-0 can often be like that as well. Like, it's a security blanket. Like, cool, let's get all the way through the actions. You might want to do it to start with just to get that initial surface level familiarity, but doing that every week is going to show up in a game pretty quickly when you get a really active defense.
Are there any benefits to to coaches using the same terminology all the time? Like, I know when I coach, I'm a, does that make sense? Like, I say that nearly every time out, every quarter time break, every half time, like, to the point where players have picked on me in the past. And like, does that make sense? Like, yeah, thanks, smartass. Sit down. Like, it's that kind of thing. But are there any benefits to that? Or how do you break that habit as a coach if you are trying to break that habit?
Oh, that's so hard. I reckon I've said certain phrases during this very interview about 50 times, and I'm telling people to be aware of their language, and I'm doing it myself. It's human nature. We go to things that are comfortable for us. We fall into old habits. Everyone does it, from senior coaches through to your beginning coach. Teachers do it too. I remember sitting in a lecture once and hearing a lecturer say, all right, I think it was like 150 times over an hour lecture. And so, I mean, that illustrates the downside of those kind of vocal tics, in that you end up focusing more on the annoyance of, all right, 157 times.
And counting it 157 times.
Right, exactly. Probably wasn't the best student in that particular class. I don't know what it was, but I apologize if that lecturer is listening. I think there's a slim chance. The awareness, it comes back to the recording. I wonder how our friend Jack is going with the GoPro on, listening back to some of those phrases that he overuses. We've all got them. We need to embrace them. We need to be aware of them. But to get them down to zero, I think, is something that's going to put a lot of pressure on us as coaches, and as we were talking about before, take away some of that natural flair and the flow state that we want to be in as coaches.
Often when you've got those phrases, I've found in dealing with coaches and looking at my own coaching, it's generally around giving them a chance to ask a question if they need to. You know, so it's like you're saying, does that make sense? You're giving them an opportunity to say, no, I don't get it. So I think if you've built that culture of that it's safe to ask questions, it's safe to say, I don't understand. You know, if you say, does that make sense? And a kid sticks their paw up and says, actually, no, I don't get it. And you crack it. Well, then that kid's never going to do that again. So I think if we've got those sort of phrases or whatever it is, does that make sense is a massive one for me as well. But then it doesn't make sense to somebody, our reaction will determine what that culture of that program, team, whatever it might be, becomes. So then your phrase becomes redundant, because your athlete's, well, I'm not asking, because last time, you know, Rob asked, he lost his, the coach lost it, and I don't want to be in that position. So I think, you know, it's, like you said, if we try and take all of the quirks out of what we do and get it down to zero, like you said, we're going to lose the opportunity for them to say, I don't get it, but we're also going to lose parts of us as coaches.
I know that I have said that's a super important point about 50 times in this interview, which means that nothing's a super important point, but that's a super important point. You can't get things down to zero. You have to embrace it. That awareness, I think, is huge. I tried something in one of my tutes at uni yesterday where, so next week, ironically, our topic in this particular class is questioning techniques as a coach or as a PE teacher. And so I found myself being conscious of that throughout the shoot. And at one point I said, does that make sense? And everyone went, and I said, great, next week we're going to cover why that was a terrible question. And instead, I asked the students, if you were a complete novice and seeing this for the very first time, what would you be having trouble with? And that forced them instead to go, okay, what are the difficult things about this? And they had to reflect on their own understanding and compare where they're at now with where they were when they first saw it. And so on this particular slide of the tute, we had three different approaches to training design, basically. And one of the diagrams had arrows everywhere, and the kid puts up his hand and says, not a kid, he's an adult in a university. And he said, when I first saw it, those lines were super confusing. And so we then had a conversation around, okay, what helped you to understand? And so we could actually flesh out their understanding through asking a different question rather than the, do we all get that?
Yeah.
I understand in the middle of a timeout, fourth quarter with a minute to go, you probably haven't got time to sit around the campfire and sing Kumbaya. You probably want to get it over and done with a bit faster. But this is probably something to focus more on in training when you've got the time to.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any correlation between how positive or negative coaches are depending on the game situation? Like, we think of 2.4 seconds on the clock. How much do you need to pump up your players in that situation with positive feedback versus lament the fact that you've just given up an open layup down the other end, which has put you in a position where you now need a game winner?
Yeah, it can go either way in those high-pressure situations. So one of the things I found through my PhD studies was that so I coded coach feedback in a winning quarter or in a losing quarter to look at how that changes. And you see the obvious, like more positive stuff when it's going well and more negative stuff when it's not going well. But then this really interesting thing where if it was a really tight quarter, so we got a stat for whether the game was still in the balance or not based on historical data on, you know, teams and their margins. And we found that feedback became just a lot more frequent in those tight situations. So coaches felt like they needed to control the game more. They needed to prescribe a little more and get more messages to players. So I think I mentioned before about, you know, constraints operating on us as coaches, and that pressure of late game situations is one of the most influential constraints on the way that we coach, essentially. So being aware of that and knowing whether you're a pumper-upper or whether you're a maybe a little more negative and controlling and blowing up during those late game situations, every coach is different. Every player will respond differently to that as well. Some might need the hand on the shoulder and the, you know, let's just backing you in here. Let's, like, if you get the ball, like, take that shot. Others might need the getting a little bit ripped into, like, obviously repair the relationship afterwards. But you'll be inclined a certain way as a coach, and your players will be preferring different things in those like game situations. And it's kind of a happy mess of how will it come out? You'll find out on the next episode. it's lots of moving parts in there. I'd be really interested to hear coaches' experiences. If you're listening in, like, chuck a comment up on the Twitter feed or wherever you found it. And it'd be a really interesting conversation.
Is there benefit in the aim to be consistent? So how you message in the first quarter, regardless of winning quarter, losing quarter, being the same in 30 seconds to go in the fourth, you know, 1 point up or 1 point down. Like, is there benefit in just that messaging and that delivery being the same, or do you think it needs to change in some way to, I guess, either highlight the tenseness or whatever you want to call it of the situation, or take that out of it? Like, what have you, I guess, seen or experienced?
It depends is the real cop-out answer there. We don't really have good evidence from a scientific perspective about, you know, whether consistency is better or whether adapting is better. Certainly from watching expert coaches over my years of involvement in sport, it gets tailored based on the quarter, and it needs to be natural for you as a coach. So if you have all season, you've been like hands off in the first quarter, maybe ramp it up a little in the third, and then like really ride it if it's tight late. Your players, if you get into the grand final and suddenly you're like blowing a gasket in the first quarter and then just get nervous and go to water in the last and you don't say anything, your players are going to sense that. Like, they're clever. Like, there's a level of emotional intelligence in players where they feed off what you're doing as a coach. And if you're not being yourself and you're doing something completely different, then I think they'll pick up on that, and they might be like, oh, something weird's going on, and it takes a little focus off the game. So I wouldn't recommend that people try and, you know, count their number of positive messages and keep it consistent every game. But I reckon there's a threshold in which you operate, and it might be plus or minus 10 of a certain number. And if you're in that kind of threshold, then it's probably calming to your players to have that consistency, I guess. But again, it comes down to your players. So talk to them about it. You know, do you like, you know, a bit more intensity in the last quarter? Do you find it? Some players might get super anxious with, you know, the blowing the gasket and the breaking the clipboard in the last quarter. So see what works for them.
Last one for me before I throw over to Zoe, if she's got anything else. Assistant coaches, in regard to feedback in particular, do you find it works best if your assistant coaches, say, responsible for certain players, or are they responsible for a whole playing list? And this is obviously can relate to basketball fairly heavily, where it's usually the assistant coach in a game that has to deliver feedback to a player after they've been subbed out of a game and the like. But they also have to deliver feedback to a coach. So what makes a good assistant coach in that role to be able to adapt to both?
I would like to think of myself as an expert or a specialist assistant coach in a basketball setting. I reckon I coach probably maybe 20 games all up head coaching in the VJBL. The rest of my stuff was assisting. So I found that to be my sweet spot because I like watching, observing, forming an opinion over time, taking something to the head coach where I've got stats from the last couple of plays and going, look, here's a pattern. I think a good assistant coach knows what their head coach wants and how they operate and doesn't step outside those boundaries. So as an assistant, I wouldn't go and give a whole heap of feedback on something that I know the head coach isn't totally cool with. Like the coaching group is a living, breathing organism and you don't want to, you know, there's a lot of politics involved with any coaching group. I've been fortunate to work with some awesome head coaches who have been really supportive of my development as a pretty green basketball coach. And taking me under their wing with that stuff. But that relationship and that trust is so important. Talking about, you know, separating assistant roles out into certain players or, you know, certain things that you're giving feedback on, that role clarity, super important. So we kind of had an informal setup one season where I was basically the good cop and we'd go and pump players up after they'd just been subbed out. They're sitting on the pond because they've stuffed up and was more there to give them some reflection about why they might be sitting there and get them ready to go. It's all dependent on how your head coach wants to operate. And if you can provide some support to your players that is maybe a little different to what the head coach is giving while still being aligned with the head coach's messaging, man, if you could write a book on being a good assistant, there might be some out there. Be grateful for recommendations. But yeah, lots of moving parts, very messy. I think that's the theme of the podcast, isn't it? Like be comfortable with mess because that's what coaching is.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with role clarity. You know, I've been lucky enough to work with Rob for the last couple of years and, you know, his job was always, and the athletes were aware of this, they would come out, every athlete would get feedback. But after they've had a chance to sit and have a drink and or whatever, and he would go and deliver that feedback. Now, more often than not, the feedback would just be either instructional or pumping them up a little bit because I may have not been so nice to them. But if I haven't had time to deliver, if it had to be a pointed, you know, hey, you're killing us with this or whatever it might be, poor Rob would get the talk to her about this as I walk off down the sideline. But sometimes I use that also as a mechanism between me and the athlete because I knew I was in a place that would send that athlete away from me if I was too emotional. So poor Rob had to bear the brunt of that emotion. And so I was really lucky that, you know, it was that he didn't take any of that personally or didn't go, oh, for God's sake, like you keep. And so I think having that conversation with your assistant coaches or even assistant coaches asking the questions of, you know, if you're not familiar with them as a coach, what do you like? Am I going to be in for being sort of taking the brunt of some of this? Because if they're aware of it, they can take it. It's when it comes just out of the blue, you know, why are you yelling at me? I didn't do it. Like, you know, sort of. And sometimes like when you guys were speaking about before with venting, you know, you've got to blow off some steam. Sometimes that's what happens to the assistant coach. Like you turn around, why is she doing this? Like, and the assistant coach goes, well, I don't know. Like we haven't told her to do it. But sometimes that's also something that you are providing for the head coach. You are providing and it's not great. Like you want to, I'm not saying to head coaches out there, you have a license to go and yell at your assistant coach all the time. You certainly don't have that. But that understanding, and it comes through role clarity of this is how I am as a coach, being able to reflect on what you do and your habits and things that might come up and saying, hey, look, this could happen and I will always be sorry if it does, but this could happen and I need you to just go with me on it. And then try and work on it in that time. So like in the Diamond Valley year when we were there, when you were there at the same time, he copped it a lot more than he did last year. I wasn't perfect, but it wasn't as bad. So yeah, it's well, he might tell you otherwise.
There's a nod of acknowledgement there from yeah.
Easy to say silent sometimes, mate.
No, but it is a case of understanding what your strengths are for your assistant coach as well. So, you know, in my case, having Rob sitting there, super knowledgeable, I know, like, if I say, can you talk to her about this? I know that message is going to be in line with what I want or what I need them to know. And I know that, hey, pump her up a little bit or whatever it might be, or I know he knows the athletes well enough to be able to see what they need and then deliver what they need. And again, that comes from understanding what their role is, understanding what you want and understanding who you are as a head coach.
Yeah, totally. Sometimes your assistant coach is that emotional regulator, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't want to use the term punching bag because that's a little bit too like kind of graphic potentially, but at times that's exactly what you've got to do.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in a couple of different footy environments where there's a certain coach who is just really emotionally intelligent, knows when the head coach is getting fired up and just, hey, we're on top of it. Like, I've just sent a message out. It's cool. Mm. So being able to know that that's your role and to take that on, like other assistants won't be comfortable with that.
No.
They'll, you know, when the head coach fires up, they'll get a little bit nervous. And I've worked with some assistants like that as well, where they kind of go, oh no, like they're expecting a lot of me here. Like, what do I kind of say? And that yeah. kind of get a little bit clammed up. So knowing how you operate as an assistant, I think is important. And maybe that comes down to recruiting as well. As a head coach, you might want one emotional regulator. You might want one thinker who's just going to take a heap of stats and give you, you know, patterns over time. You might want one super knowledgeable assistant who might go and chat to players down the end of the bench. So, I mean, that's something to consider as a head coach when you're recruiting.
Yeah, and even taking away some of that emotional intelligence at practice. We're running something, either the effort's not there or the skill base is waning or whatever it might be. And I remember distinctly last season, I'd had a bit of a bad day too, but
we all do as coaches.
The effort was just poor. I can handle not being able to do something, but that when the effort's poor, that's where I struggle.
Yeah.
And I brought it up, highlighted it, moved on. Highlighted it one more time with a little more pepper, step back. And then by the third, here I was. I was ready. Like I was about to catch fire. And Rob just put his hand on my shoulder and just said, I got this. And just took that off me almost. And what was amazing, or what I found amazing by that, was I didn't get offended by it. I wasn't like, oh, how dare you? This is my team or anything like that. It was, you know what, he's just saved me from losing a lot of relationships in this team because of the headspace I was in at the time and what potentially was going to come. So I think also, you know, yeah, assistant coaches take some things, like take on stuff, and they cop a lot of it, but they also save the head coach from a lot of things too, and that needs to be acknowledged. You know, it's great that they do it, but if, you know, human nature, right? If you keep doing things to help somebody and you get zero acknowledgement from it over the course of a season, well, no, I'm not coming back to assist you next year. And that person who has done so much for you is now gone. So I think yeah. head coaches need to also, you know, allow assistant coaches to be hands-on and speak and the only reason you wouldn't be okay with that is if you either haven't defined their role or haven't, I guess, educated, if you want to call it that, them on what you want. Otherwise, they should be an extension of you.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it comes down to developing that relationship from really early in the season.
Mm.
So like, how many times do we get our players practicing throughout the course of a typical BJBL season? Like, they might, however many weeks, times two sessions,
yeah,
say 100 or so, whatever it might be. How many times do we sit down as a coaching group, head coaches and assistants, and practice coaching when it's not actually a game that you're coaching live? Zero.
Yeah, it'd be almost,
There's a really an example of a really average question that was pretty predetermined. more on that next week. But it's something that I think coaches should practice. So I've heard of some groups of coaches who go go and watch a game live. They all sit together, might be pretty informal, like might grab a drink or whatever, or a bag of snakes, stay on, whatever you need to do to get in your zone. And they'll just watch the game, go, hey, what did you think of that adjustment? Yeah, cool. You see how they've countered that now? Like, what would we do if that was us in that situation? Mm. And that process, I think if you get that done a couple of times in preseason, by the time you get to the start of the season, you're well on the way to having that kind of role clarity there, and you know how each other responds in certain situations. Obviously, it's not the same as coaching a game where you're next on the line, but it helps even if you're coaching the under-12s and you've got a parent helping out as an assistant, like starting to build that shared knowledge throughout the start of, you know, grading and early in the season. I think that's can be a really valuable thing. I also acknowledge that you're not a full-time coach. Like, people have got jobs, like it can be difficult, but if you can get together on a, you know, on a Sunday afternoon and do it once or twice, I think that could potentially bear fruit.
Yep. Awesome. Mate, that's it for me. I've just seen how long we've been going for, and it feels like it's been 5 minutes, but it absolutely isn't. No. That's our fault, not yours, I assure you. Mate, thanks so much for jumping into the podcast. It's been a wealth of knowledge, I think, has been imparted for our coaches here, and certainly not from our end, absolutely from yours. So can't thank you enough for your time today. We really appreciate it, and we're pseudo Port Adelaide fans now whilst you're there anyway.
Have a few more on the bandwagon. Thanks for having me, and thanks for keeping on going with this podcast. It's such a good resource for coaches. So, yeah, appreciate all your effort to get it going.
No worries. Thanks, mate. James, for jumping in.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hopefully everyone sat down with pen and paper there, because there were so many little takeaways and nuggets that can apply to everything we do as coaches. Can't thank Rob enough for jumping into the podcast. We sort of said originally, look, it'll only probably take an hour or so, and then it was a little longer than that. But hopefully can really help a lot of coaches with how they deliver feedback to their players, what their players understand, what they don't understand, and the like as well.
Yeah, the real, I guess, clincher for me was the, you know, you've got 10 tennis balls. If you throw them at an athlete, how many are they going to catch? Or how many are they able to catch? It's, you know, we get so excited as coaches, especially in game. We get so excited about our chance to be involved in the game, because really when we're not, in a sense, the game is about the players. So when we have our chance to put our 2 cents in, sometimes that 2 cents becomes $10, and you know,
you don't get much change.
What are we expecting them to hold on to? So and then to go further on it, then if you had 5 tennis balls and 2 eggs, which would you catch? Well, what's the most important? And I think that's just a great little grab that, you know, if we can try and, obviously we can't do it at the moment, but once we get back on court, if we can try and remember that as we're, you know, heading into our timeout, heading into our quarter time, and even on court in practice, of less is more, pick your battles, you know, and go from there.
I loved, and he said it at the very start, you know, you don't want the first time you realise your players don't know something to be in the moment that matters. So all the work that goes into it at training, all the preparation and those kinds of things, rehearsing, that matters a lot to find out if your players actually do understand something. And what's really cool is that we've got a professional level coach in Ken Hinckley that was also a player, has been through every pathway possible within the AFL landscape, but is still happy to, and this is no disrespect to Rob, so I do apologise for this, but he's still happy to take on board feedback from Rob, who's never played footy other than his primary school days, as to how he can become a better coach. And it's all about the delivery methods and the engagement and those kinds of things as well, which I think can be really lost on a lot of people. You don't have to have the world's greatest technical knowledge, but if you can motivate, inspire and teach, well, you're a big chance of going places as a coach.
Yeah, I really enjoyed how, you know, to help with the coaching staff, with when Rob is then to give them feedback on how they're going and if their message is getting through, that when the coaches or the staff are up delivering their messages, Rob's not even looking at them. Like, it's got nothing to do with what, or sorry, his care or his focus is on the athletes. So he's just watching the athletes. Are they locked in? Are they interested? Are they maybe a bit overstimulated, or is it a little too much? And I think that's a really valuable exercise, I think, that coaches could do, especially if you're lucky enough to have assistant coaches or other staff, to have them actually, hey, can you just keep your eyes on the players? Because when you're delivering a you know, information or instruction or whatever type speech that you need to be giving in that given time, yes, you're looking at your athletes, but more often than not, your focus is delivering the message. And so to have someone designated there to be able to say, actually, I don't think this message is getting through, and this is why, or how we then tailor that message to make sure it hits on that athlete was, yeah, I thought that was great. I think that's a really valuable exercise.
Even things like Jack Fleming coaching with the GoPro, so he can see, like, yet another Jack Fleming mentioned on a podcast, who's fast becoming the person spoken about the most that's not actually appeared on the podcast at this point. But those kinds of things are great to see coaches at our VJBL and our state team level investing in. Mm. Like, that's a great tool for learning a little bit more. It's funny, when we started this podcast, I was the smartest Rob that has ever been on the podcast, and unfortunately I'm now third behind both Rob Mason and Rob Beveridge.
No Robs.
More than anything else. But again, thanks to Rob Mason for jumping into the podcast. We hope we didn't take up too much of your Friday morning in particular as we went through this. As always, we'd love coaches to throw out on Twitter any of the things that were relevant to them. Please do tag it in with the hashtag on Talking Split, and we'll try and interact with you guys as much as we possibly can. If there are any topics you'd like us to cover off over the coming weeks as well, in particular as we're still in this sort of lockdown period, more than happy to hear that too. Please do reach out if there's anything in particular that you would like to discuss, and we can go from there. Big thanks to everyone for Talking Split with us, and hopefully we'll see everyone back and on court soon.